How do one and all? It's another oneliner.com podcast. I, as always, am Craig Eastman, and approximately 240 miles to my north, Scott Morris.
That would be me.
And approximately 250 miles north by northeast, Drew Tavendale.
That's me.
Yes. I can't back those directions up with paperwork. We are talking tonight about Taken 2, Rust and Bone. And if I'm not very much mistaken, Argo, he said, very quickly bringing back up the list of, of films before he gets caught out. So without further ado, let us crack on. We've spoken about this many times, and what the world needed was a sequel to Taken. Drew, I understand that's happened.
It has.
Wow.
And from your tone, it sounds that, like me, you were a little worried about this film existing at all. Apparently, the first Taken was a fairly simple concept, and after Liam Neeson had killed more or less everyone, there didn't seem anywhere else to go, really.
Without... If you're listening to this podcast, you were lucky to get away.
Yes. Count your blessings every day that Liam Neeson didn't kill you. You're one of the few. So, I mean, after he killed more or less everyone, it didn't seem anywhere else to go without going down the whole Die Hard to how can the same shit happen to the same guy twice route. Fortunately, though, the writers took a route closer to Die Hard with a Vengeance and had Liam Neeson's Brian Mills and his family specifically targeted for revenge by the families of the gangsters he often pars.
Interesting and original plot device.
Indeed, but not quite as tenuous a connection with the characters some series have had, even if the sequel is very much unnecessary. Beyond being set in Istanbul, though, rather than the French capital, Taken 2 is very similar to the first film, with the only notable differences being that it is Brian's ex-wife who's in need of rescue, through the medium of termination with extreme prejudice, of course, and his daughter is helping him out this time rather than being a captive herself. And there's not a lot more to say. If you've seen the first film, you know largely how this is going to go. If you've not seen it, you can explain it in a one sentence. Somebody's pissed off Liam Neeson, he goes and kills everybody to get things right. It's not the most complex of films.
Brian Mills gonna sort it out. But Brian spelt with a Y, sorry, so that it's a little bit more edgy.
Yes.
And Mills is spelt with a Z at the end.
Mills is spelt with a fuck you at the end. Yeah.
Punctuated with a bullet. Taken 2, though, does get most of what was so enjoyable about the first film right again. And Neeson is believable as the extremely capable former CIA operative. His physicality again lends real credence to the visceral fight scenes. After a fairly slow start, the film bombs along at a brisk pace and even manages to add in a little humour amidst the hand-to-hand combat, car chases and shootouts. Unfortunately, too long spent in the setup, which leaves less time for Brian to deal out brutal death, which is a bit of a silly thing to do given that's the entire point. And in the end, this film simply isn't nearly stupid enough.
It's not a criticism we level often.
Yeah, it's not something you'll hear come from us very often, but in this case it's true. So while it can't quite match Taken, Taken 2 is still an enjoyable way to spend 90 minutes. If you enjoyed the first film, you'll get some pleasure out of this. Don't expect Citizen Kane, but it's fun enough.
Interesting, interesting. Scott, did you see Taken 2?
Yeah, same logic as Drew, but with slightly worse results. It's mediocre at best. As Drew said, the first film was stupid enough to be like brainlessly enjoyable, but Taken 2 is only stupid enough to just be stupid. And I know realism is not a strong point in the Taken genre, but consequence-free grenade-based echolocation is kind of pushing it a bit much even for me. It took forever to get started, and by that point I just couldn't be bothered with it. And that bit at the start, when it's just his family talking to each other, is curiously stilted, given that everyone involved's at best a decent actor. Liam's normally charismatic enough to pull that kind of stuff off, but all the interplay between him and Famke Janssen is just kind of bland and boring, and it takes forever to get started. And by that point I just couldn't be bothered to get much into it, and it did seem to kind of start stop a little bit as well after that, which is not what I'm looking for in my high octane adrenaline thrill lights. It's not all bad, but it's a bit by the numbers. It's a bit cursory. It's mediocre and a little bit dull, and it's not really worth your attention. I would pass on this one. You'll watch far worse action films, but why bother with this one?
I'll be giving it a pass because I understand it's perhaps one of the most cynically constructed films of all time, and that it's been edited down specifically to achieve a 12 rating here, like PG-13 if you're in the States, which kind of again defeats the purpose of everything that Taken stood for, if you can believe Taken stood for anything other than sort of being a poster child for Daily Mail readers. Kind of, oh, shoot the foreign man, yay!
To be fair, the foreign man had it coming.
The foreign man had it coming. Don't they all? Don't they all, Scott? If only we all realised we were foreign in each other's eyes. Yeah, I'm led to believe that this was a far more brutal film, and it's been edited down purely because, I mean, obviously Taken was far more of a success than anyone expected it to be, and I think they've gone, okay.
Or logic would dictate.
Yeah, yes. Let's use the same formula. We know this is probably the last time it's going to work. So the stage scenery, people can see behind the stage scenery. So let's just pump this out to as big an audience as we can, just to get as much money as possible. And for that reason, I will not be giving them my cash. Thank you very much. Any saving grace at all? Is there any reason why I should even check this out on demand when it becomes available via that channel?
No.
I got some enjoyment out of it, but it'd be better off just watching the original again.
Mm. Or not, in my opinion. I was never a fan anyway, but...
I say, if you're going to go brainless, go totally brainless and watch Crank 2.
Yes.
Yes! Crank 2, available via Blinkbox, who have it listed in amongst their comedies, which is spot on. That is the best judgment call I have come across in recent times. I had to tweet about it the other night, actually. Scrolling through the list of comedies, I feel like something lighthearted. Scrolling through the list on Blinkbox, Crank 2, yes, yes it is. Scott, a lot of talk in award circles and such of the film Rust and Bone, starring Marion Cotillard and Matthias Schoenaerts. Can you tell us much about that?
Tell you some about that.
Nice.
Marion Cotillard plays Stephanie. She trains killer whales, although apparently not well enough.
Oh.
Step one in the process, always train your killer whales not to chew your legs off. Basics.
Train the killer whale Basics. Not to kill.
She's punished for this schoolboy error by having her legs chewn off by a killer whale, and yes, chewn is a perfectly good word, thank you. Stumpy, understandably upset by this turn of events, enters a depressive cycle that's only broken when she takes the unusual and, some would say, inexplicable step of reaching out and calling a vague acquaintance, Alan, played by Matthias.
I think acquaintance is a bit strong, isn't it?
Well, they did meet once. Elaine was a bouncer who drove her home after she was assaulted at a nightclub, but we, as a viewing audience, have known him for a little bit longer. We first meet him, well, more or less, when he's stealing a camera. Sure, it's to sell to feed his son, but it's still hardly an endearing introduction. He's on his way across country to eventually stay with his sister, whereupon he settles in for a good stretch of completely ignoring his son's wants and needs. Despite Elaine hardly being a model of compassion, he does start helping Stephanie deal with her new situation and, in a largely separate development, becomes a fighter in France's apparently burgeoning illegal backyard fighting tournaments. The bulk of the film concerns Stephanie and Elaine's developing relationship and how their actions change their personalities and their dispositions. So perhaps I'll skip over any details. However, I do rather get the impression that this is trying to say a lot more about the human condition than I was able to take from it. It's great that Stephanie manages to find value in her life again, but perhaps unfortunate that so much of it is based around the attention of a total asshole. Alan's unpleasant, but not in the ways I think we were supposed to take him as. I'm assuming we're supposed to think of this guy as a complicated and realistic human, with a mixture of, you know, good and bad characteristics, and a lot of the film's value comes from watching how the good begins to outweigh the bad in his makeup as the relationship with Stephanie develops. But unfortunately, that first reel does such a good job of setting Alan up as a lying, stealing, child-neglecting jackass that I'm not particularly inclined to care about his redemption and or otherwise. I suppose I can see in a kind of detached way that if you had some interest in his character, then the final reel would be very affecting. But long before that, I grew tired of his antics and was thinking about funny videos of cats instead. If I could get over my distaste for the one central character in the film, then there's not actually very much that Rust and Bone does wrong. There's maybe an occasional drop into overly stylistic framing and particular use of this, overuse rather, of this shot into the sun lens flare type motif. But at least that gives it a strong and consistent visual style. The acting is impeccable, as best as I can gather without actually being able to speak French. There's lots of, you know, really raw emotion on here, and that's all very believable, and that does work very well. The direction shows consideration of the movie's pace, and overall it's quite assured, even when it's dealing with a sudden shift in genre, like becoming an illegal bare-knuckle boxing exposition. There are an awful lot of positives around this film, and I can see why a lot of people really do like it. It's just that it kind of bounced off me. I don't know if that says more about me than the film, but I just couldn't find anything here to really latch on to and properly care about. I mean, despite the fact that I can't really sit here and say there's really anything at all wrong with Rust and Bone, I just didn't like it very much. It just made no impact on me. And I'm sure there's a few other instances of films like this in the past where it's been a very good film in all ways that I can possibly logically explain it to you, but it's just kind of, yeah, it didn't really do much for me. And unfortunately, Rust and Bone is one of these. I wouldn't want to dissuade anyone from seeing it, because if you can get over this distaste for one of the characters, I think it actually would be a very good film. I mean, you become very affected by it, but I just kind of tuned out by that point. It just, eh.
I wasn't actually aware of the plot of this before you started talking, to be honest. Drew and sorry, Scott. Easy mistake to make, man. I've only known you minutes, both of you.
Yeah.
I understand it was attracting a lot of attention and plaudits and stuff. I wasn't actually aware of the plot. And now hearing you describe the plot, what annoys me about it is that kind of European cinema thing of, okay, we're going to have this woman. Okay, she places her trust and her belief in a beast, and the beast eats her legs. Okay, she's the kind of. She's the kind of person who's going to put her trust and belief in another beast, because now she's got no legs to be chewed, and she's going to redeem that again. Yeah, so. That can happen again. She's going to redeem that beast. And then they've gone, right, that'll be a really powerful message. Now, how do we set that up? Well, the beast she's going to redeem, he's this brutal guy. He's a horrible character. He's a nightclub bouncer. Yeah, he's a bit rough in that. He's got a son. His son's probably quite nice. He neglects his son, okay, so he's a bit of an asshole. She's going to redeem him. Right, what's the beast that eats her legs? Oh, she's a killer whale trainer. Right, okay, because we all know one of those, so I'm going to empathise with her straight away. That's not a specialist path in life she's chosen. That immediately turns me off. If she had been a woman taking her shopping down the street when a bus ran over her and she lost her legs, I would invest myself in this film straight away. When someone tells me the film opens with a killer whale trainer getting her legs bitten off, and then she decides she's going to redeem the life of a nightclub bouncer who's a bit of an arse, right, okay. Did you say it was European? Yeah, okay, right, okay, yeah, bye.
It is particularly random when, as we mentioned, they've only actually met once before, and we're given no indication that this woman lacks for friends or anything like that. She just decides out of the blue, like, oh, I'm depressed, I know, I'll phone a bouncer. It didn't gel. It didn't make a lot of sense to me at that point.
It's just, I don't know, I've just got in my head this notion of like, who's a killer whale trainer? That's like some sort of trust fund kid job. Like, oh, it's terrible. Tarquin...
keeps us toboggan lovely.
That's it. He was taking a break. He was in his gap year. He was training a killer whale and it ate his legs. It's been terribly debilitating for him. Yeah.
He's totally miffed.
Yes, it's killer whale. Right, click, next. interesting that. Scott, Drew, sorry, I've done it again. Drew, did you see Rust and Bone at all?
I did, yes.
And what were your feelings on it?
They're similar to Scott, so I think I maybe liked it a bit less. And I'm not sure if I see a good film in here, actually. The performances are excellent. Scott's comments about the direction are right as well. I just didn't think that the story was particularly strong. And as Scott said, there's a problem with this guy not being particularly likable. But I also didn't think he was either like not likable enough or not unlikable enough. If that makes any sense to you at all.
Why, of course.
Like, it wasn't like a complete bastard that he could be redeemed or anything. It was just a bit of a prat for a lot of it. And then he's a terrible father. But I've seen much worse characters in films. And this one just left me feeling a bit cold one way or the other. I'd preferred to have, you know, either really wanted him to do well or really hated him. And when it comes to, there's something in the final reel where basically a big drama bomb's inserted, and I could see it coming for the whole scene up to it, and it kind of pissed me off when it did happen, though, but it didn't fit. There was a perfect opportunity earlier on for the consequences of his actions to really affect this other character that later happens as an accident later on, which I don't know if you realize anybody's not seen this. There's no idea what I'm talking about.
I know what the drama bomb is. Does she later find out that this bouncer who she's fallen in love with and whose life she has made worthwhile, does it actually transpire that at the time of her losing her legs, he was dressed as a killer whale?
Yep, that's it. Or spoil. Should I have a spoiler alert on there? no, it's something happens to a character which affects Alan, and it's like there was a perfect opportunity for it to happen earlier and be a direct consequence of his action, whereas it happens as an accident instead.
Yeah.
And it just felt much weaker for it and much more forced.
They've contrived to put an accident in when there was a perfectly believable, normal accident earlier that would have sufficed to do the same job.
It would be, and it would have been much more powerful for it
too. I can guess almost.
So that bothered me, that felt contrived towards the end when it could have been done much better earlier on. And I mean, I suppose it's an interesting enough film to watch. I mean, in no way is it a bad film. I just didn't find the story particularly compelling. And it's sort of all these little flaws that kind of add up. Like, as Scott said, the woman who has met this guy once and maybe showed a wee bit of kindness to her, and she goes, oh, I'm really depressed, and even though my friends visit me in the hospital every day, and other friends have been mentioned, and I've got several brothers and a mother who have bothered to contact me, no, I'm really depressed, so phone this bouncer guy, I don't know. And there's a few wee things like that, maybe not wee, but they add up quite a bit. But it's just not, I don't see why everybody's raving about it so much. Mm. It's a decidedly all right film. The performances are very good, which is what perhaps lifts it a bit.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's not the most compelling story, and it also features way too much Katy Perry songs.
Oh, what?
See?
I was about to say, like, Marion Cotillard's usually value for money when she's not ranting on about 9/11 conspiracy theories and stuff, but then I'm thinking, oh, check it out. I don't know, you know. I sometimes disagree on the odd film here and there. You know, maybe the guys are talking shit, but yeah, Katy Perry songs, right? Bye, bye, bye. There you go. That's that then. Bloody French. On to a film called Argo, directed by Ben Affleck, who, in 70s long hair and greying beard, I find oddly attractive. Scott, what can you tell me about this year's Drive?
Do you mean Drew?
Drew, what can you tell me about... So
it's so hard to tell these days, isn't it? For you, apparently.
It's the rum. Drew, what can you tell me about this year's Drive?
This year's Drive, in that is your man crush for this year, not because the film's in any way similar, just to clear up any confusion there for our listeners.
I think the phrase is well enough recognised. People understand Craig's man crush of the year.
It's happened for 1 year so far, but yes, it's well established.
Yes. The internet gets it, man.
I believe it is on Know Your Meme somewhere.
Yes.
In the 1970s, the Western powers were again deciding that while democracy was just fine and dandy for them, it really wouldn't do for other countries, particularly other countries with oil, and that instead they'd choose who runs their country. Thank you very much. In Iran, this led to a revolution and the overthrow of the Western-friendly Shah and the installation as supreme leader type fella, the wonderful Ayatollah Khomeini, that well-balanced individual. A lot of anti-US sentiment had risen up in Iran at the time, which culminated in the invasion of the US embassy in Tehran and the labelling of all embassy employees as spies. During the chaos, 6 embassy workers managed to escape and, after being turned away by the embassies of several other countries, were offered refuge in the house of the Canadian ambassador. The time that they could stay there, though, was limited, and before they were found and all involved, including the ambassador and his wife, were tried and likely executed as spies, they had to be extracted. So enter CIA agent Tony Mendez, played by Ben Affleck, a specialist in exfiltration, who must invent convincing cover stories for the 6 embassy staff, and then enter Iran himself to train them to know it back to front. The cover story comes up with, improbable as it may seem, particularly given that this is actually a more or less true story, certainly based on a true story, he comes up with a cover story of them being a Canadian film crew scouting locations in Tehran for a Star Wars knockoff, the Argo of the title. This is Ben Affleck's third outing as director, and he proves beyond doubt that, yes, he's a damned capable helmer, and no, he doesn't have to work in Boston, which the second part of which may come as a great surprise to many people. And to make that last point triply clear, Argo has 3 strands set in 3 very different locations with 3 very different tones. In gritty, grainy Iran, all is tense and nervous. In Washington, Mendez and his boss fight political battles to get their plan accepted. And in sunny, colourful Hollywood, John Goodman and Alan Arkin work to make the fake film seem real while cracking wise about the business. The 3 strands work together magnificently. The patently absurd nature of both the fake film and Hollywood help to sell why Mendez's Washington superiors and the embassy employees are so reluctant to go through with such a crazy scheme, but also serve to provide relief from the tense scenes of the hostages and fugitives in Iran, and none of it feels out of place. The performances are uniformly excellent, from Alan Arkin's wisecracking producer, That's Alan Arkin playing somebody who cracks wise is a real change for him. But since it's always awesome, we're not bored of it yet. So from his wisecracking producer to Scoot McNairy as the most reluctant of the fugitives in the Canadian embassy, to Affleck's own turn as the man responsible for giving these people the best chance they have of leaving Iran alive. There are minor issues. Affleck seems to have been at pains to get things looking just like they were in 1980, and while the period detail is excellent, the casting of actors to look as much like the actual people is quite spectacularly unnecessary, especially as it's completely undermined by the fact that Ben Affleck's cast himself as the CIA extraction expert when he looks nothing like him.
Yeah, but we're all familiar. Ben Affleck aside, we're all familiar with the faces involved, Drew.
Yes.
We just wouldn't buy it otherwise.
Yeah, you're right. It's not unnecessary at all. They even got people who stay with people's hair the same. Anyway, the denouement also features a sequence inserted to create tension, which admittedly works, but doesn't make a great deal of sense in the context, and there's a subplot involving Mendez's son, which could be dropped completely. Those really are minor points. Argo is an extremely competent thriller from an extremely competent director, and it comes highly recommended.
Nice, nice. I just want to pick up on a couple of points. First of all, Affleck hasn't directed three times, he's directed five times, actually. You've neglected, obviously we were considering Gone Baby Gone, The Town.
I'm sorry, I forgot the two shorts because yes. Those count so much.
Yes, and Argo. You forgot Gimme Shelter in 2008 and 1993's seminal I Killed My Lesbian Wife, Hung Her on a Meat Hook, and Now I Have a Three-Picture Deal at Disney.
Yes.
Which I thought was disgusting because yes. You didn't get a three-picture deal at Disney. That was a lie.
I also just want to pick up on perhaps the least expected goof I've ever seen, given the context of the film and the setting and period. The sort of goof which the IMDb app on my iPad has brought up is, during the table read scene, the robot who speaks has blue LEDs for eyes. Blue LEDs were not invented until 1993. What? Robots? What?
It wasn't a real robot.
What?
No, it's basically a C-3PO knockoff when they're trying to get the film made.
Oh, okay.
It's not actually to do with the hostage bit.
Yeah, knockoff sci-fi film. Sorry, that had gone out of my head. I'm just
like
70s.
Not the Iran bit.
Yeah, I'm thinking 70s period drama in Iran with a robot with blue glowing eyes doing a reading at a table.
So I don't remember the Ayatollah Khomeini looking like a robot with blue LEDs for lie.
No.
It doesn't seem accurate.
And anyone who portrays him as such will have a jihad upon them.
And if you don't believe it, I'll call a jihad on you.
What would Brian Mills say about all this, eh? Scott, what were your impressions of Argo?
Much the same as Drew, probably minus the negatives. I really liked Argo. It's at least in contention for my film of the year.
Scott, I don't mean to misunderstand me. I think perhaps because I liked it so much, those wee bits stuck out, but they were very, very minor. I mean,
Shut up, you've called your shots.
I kind of take what you're saying about the casting, but at the same time, I don't think anyone else would have done any better. So
no,
it's got all the positives of them looking at real people and also having good performances, so I don't see that as an issue.
Yeah, looking at the cast,
they're uniformly excellent. It just seemed that bit just seemed so pointless.
Yeah, but,
they did really well, and that's fine. As I said, it was uniformly excellent. Not quite sure why he did that, especially when he's undermined it by sticking himself here because he wanted to be in it.
I am looking at that cast list thinking, yeah, I'm looking at the next three top billed cast after Affleck, and yeah, I'd pretty much put them in anything. I'd ask Alan Arkin to play Dorothy in a remake of Oz, to be honest.
Attention to detail is fabulous. It's awfully very tense at points. The level of detail, the recreation of the events that I've seen when it's compared to like newsreel footage, it's borderline autistic. The contrast between the kind of moments of tension and the guys in Hollywood sort of yucking it up works really well. It's just a really, really good story. And it's been told very, very well.
And it's a handsome beard.
It's such a handsome beard.
Although, I'll be honest, it's the hair as well. Come on.
Doesn't look very Hispanic, grant you. But that aside, I think it's one of the year's best films. So
go and watch it,
and you will enjoy it, because it is a good film. And you like good films, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. You know what's good for you. All right, interesting little bunch we spoke about there, I have to say. I will be catching up with Argo. I want to be catching up with Taken. And I think Rust and Bone might be one for On Demand, provided, or rather on the proviso, that I can employ some sort of Katy Perry filter. I don't know. Some sort of Katy Perry cancelling audio device or something like that, that reacts dynamically to soundtracks and removes any trace of Katy Perry by emitting anti-frequencies to known Katy Perry recordings. Will that work, do you think?
It's worth a go. Shall we start a Kickstarter?
Yeah, why not? It's the rum talking. On which note, I say thank you for listening. Remember, you can email us on podcast@theoneliner.com. You can follow us on Twitter @theoneliner. You can find us on there individually as well. Get in touch. Do what you like. Be at one with us. If you can spare 3 seconds, go on iTunes, rate us, leave a comment. You wouldn't believe what a difference it makes to our rankings. If you can spare even just £2 a month or something,
you can
set up a direct debit. Yes, exactly.
Many childs would be saved by use.
Just £2 a month will inoculate us. It'll treat the glaucoma.
I won't have to walk 50 miles to a well every morning.
It'll only take 15 of you a month at £2 a month to buy me a bottle of Sailor Jerry for every podcast. It's worth it. Look into your hearts. I was Craig Eastman. Scott was Scott.
Bye.
And Drew was Drew.
Fare thee well.
We will see you soon. Neeson, what are you going to do that for, Liam?